Back in the ancient Near East of the second book of Kings, national security is often far from secure. Kings are constantly forming coalitions against other kingdoms and exacting heavy taxes from those nations which they have defeated. It was David's victories that filled the temple coffers with gold and other treasures, and Rehoboam's defeat to the Egyptians under Shishak that emptied them again. Relations between Israel and Judah have thus far remained cordial, despite each having its own worship center, Jerusalem in Judah and the golden calves at Bethel and Dan in Israel. And despite Israel leaning ever more towards paganism rather than capital G God worship. All this, however, is about to change. The Reaper is coming in the form of a rogue army commander from Israel. My name is Chaz Bayfield, and this is Holy Bible Episode 87, A Pile of Human Heads. Hello everyone, and welcome to the only podcast on the airwaves that treats the Bible as a book rather than a sacred, untouchable text. The Bible, believe it or not, was written by humans over a number of centuries. Some say that those humans were fallible, prejudiced, biased, or at the very least had an agenda. Others say that they were inspired by the Holy Spirit and that their words are infallible. The purpose of this podcast is not to sit in judgment over which approach is the right one. Instead, I simply get stuck into the story, retelling it like a modern-day tour guide, adding a bit of context where helpful. We're currently in the Old Testament second book of Kings, which is one of the Bible's most exciting books. Plenty of murder, subterfuge, and warfare as the leaders of a handful of Near Eastern nations battle for supremacy in the first millennium BC. So, grab a coffee, buckle up, we're going in. Like his relatively saintly father Jehoshaphat, and, as far as names go, it's easy to confuse him with Joram, king of Israel. Joram rules at the same time, is equally godless, and is also known as Jehoram. During his 8-year reign, Jehoram of Judah rules more like a pagan king of Israel than a godly king of Judah. According to the book, God views him as an evil ruler rather than a good one. Matters are made worse by the king marrying a daughter of Ahab and Jezebel, a woman who will plough her own destructive path after his death. As with all Judah's kings who fall far short of the gold standard set by David, readers are told that Jehoram is spared the humiliation of seeing his nation destroyed because of God's promise to keep David's royal line intact forever. At the time of Jehoram's rule, the neighbouring nation of Edom is a vassal state of Judah, but in an act of defiance, the Edomites decide to instate their own king. Keen to snuff out the rebellion before it gathers too much momentum, Jehoram sets off with his chariots, but soon finds himself surrounded. He is able to break through the Edomite cordon at night, but clearly lacking confidence in their king's ability to lead them, his army deserts him. The failure to suppress Edom means that the Edomites continue to pose a threat to Judah at the time the book is being written, sometime after 586 BC, over 250 years later. Inspired by Edom's spunky resistance, the city of Libna also revolts, and the Bible's message is clear. Judah is weaker when its kings fail to follow God. Once Jehoram is dead and his deeds recorded in the book of the Annals of the Kings of Judah, a book which sadly no longer exists, his 22-year-old son Ahaziah becomes king. Tainted with the blood of Ahab and Jezebel, his mother Athaliah is their daughter, it is no surprise that he makes a less than optimum ruler of Judah. If you missed the previous episodes, Ahab ruled Israel with his pagan wife Jezebel, a queen who persecuted and killed Jewish prophets while employing around 400 prophets of her own who worshipped Baal, Asherah, and other Canaanite deities. Fortunately for the southern kingdom, Ahaziah's reign is a brief one, lasting just 1 year. Ahaziah is a nephew of Israel's King Joram, and the two of them go into battle against Hazael, who by now is king of Aram. Skip back to the previous episode to see how that particular adventure played out. The battle takes place at Ramoth Gilead, where Ahab was fatally wounded, and Joram of Israel is badly wounded in this skirmish. He retires to his palace in Jezreel to recover, where Ahaziah visits him, not realizing that both kings will die here. The narrator doesn't remain in Judah for long, as drama is unfolding in the northern kingdom. Israel is about to fall under the rule of its first almost godly king. With Joram of Israel incapacitated and recuperating back in his royal palace in Jezreel, his military commander Jehu remains in Ramoth Gilead, which the Israelites have now successfully recaptured. The prophet Elisha, who has dominated the last few episodes, sends one of the prophets who he lives amongst to Jehu with a flask of oil. Those who've been with us for a while will know that the prophet is up to his old tricks again. It appears that he sees the whole picture, but only reveals it one glimpse at a time. Hence, the prophet bringing oil. The prophet is to find an opportunity for a private one-on-one with the commander, pour the oil on his head, and inform him that he will be Israel's next king. This ritual is common in the Bible and is known as anointing. It happened to Saul, David, and a number of other kings and priests. The prophet is then to run away to avoid any questions and possibly to add impact to the message. The young holy man finds Jehu and carries out his task, telling the commander that it is God's will that he should be king and that his legacy will be the destruction of Ahab's dynasty. This is a direct reference to Joram of Israel. The king is Ahab and Jezebel's son, and the messenger explains that the deaths of all the prophets killed by these two need avenging. Ahab's family will be utterly wiped out, he promises, just like Jeroboam's and Baasha's before them, adding that Jezebel will be eaten by dogs, her body remaining unburied. The prophet then turns on his heels and flees the place as instructed. Jehu's men assume that the man was deranged and that their commander risked his personal safety being alone with him. Jehu remains coy as to what just happened, and only when pressed does he spill the beans and share the promises made to him by the prophet. His men's response is emphatic. They place their cloaks on the ground, blow a trumpet, and declare their leader king. At the time, Israel's actual king, Joram, and Judah's king, Ahaziah, are still holed up in Joram's palace at Jezreel. Jehu urges any Israelite who wants him to be their king to keep their plans a secret so that surprise is on their side. Jehu then hitches up his chariot and leads his troops out to pay the two kings a visit. Curious as to why his own army is making an unscheduled station stop at his home, Joram sends a messenger out from the palace to ask if Jehu comes in peace. The commander asks the man what peace has to do with anything and orders him to fall in line with the rest of the army, which he does. Unnerved that the envoy hasn't returned, Jehu sends a second man who also falls in behind Jehu. The lookout on the city wall reports all this back to Joram and adds that the man in the chariot at the head of the army drives like a maniac, so must be Jehu. This is the first we have heard about Jehu's driving, but from a distance in an age before binoculars, any idiosyncrasies such as this that help identify an approaching visitor are useful. At this point, Joram and Ahaziah both climb into chariots of their own and ride out to meet the threat. Once outside the citadel, Joram is able to ask Jehu face to face if this is a peaceful visit. The army commander asks him how there can be peace while Joram's mother Jezebel still actively encourages witchcraft and idol worship in Israel. The moment is made more powerful because the place where they are standing had once been a vineyard owned by a man named Naboth. Skip back to episode 82 to see how Jezebel had Naboth killed so that she and her husband could grab the land for themselves and plant a garden. Realising that the game is up and wrongly assuming that it is Ahaziah who has betrayed him, Joram flees, calling his royal cousin a traitor. Jehu then fires an arrow that pierces Joram's heart, killing him. He orders the king's body to be dumped in Naboth's former vineyard, reminding the officer in charge of Israel's chariots of the prophecy spoken against Ahab years earlier. He tells him that Ahab would be punished for the deaths of Naboth and his sons, though this appears to be a paraphrase of the prophecy, as there is no record of Ahab and Jezebel killing Naboth's children. Still, no one is checking details as the corpse of Israel's king is unceremoniously dumped on the ground, where it is left unburied. Seeing what has just happened, King Ahaziah of Judah flees in his chariot, but the Israelite army gives chase, with Jehu yelling orders to kill him too. The king is wounded, but escapes to the city of Megiddo, where he later dies, the first king of Judah to die violently since Saul. His body is taken back to Jerusalem by his servants, where it is buried in David's tomb. Joram may be dead, but his mother Jezebel is still very much alive, having outlived both her husband and now her son. Few accounts in the Bible are as filled with schadenfreude as the death of its most pagan queen. As soon as she hears that Jehu and the Israelite army are about to enter Jezreel, Jezebel puts on her makeup and fixes up her hair. She knows that there is a chance that she will die, and it appears that she wants to go out in style. The queen waits by an upper window, and when she sees Jehu arrive, she accuses him of being like Zimri, the ambitious but ill-fated commander who murdered Israel's king Elah in a failed coup. She asks if the commander comes in peace, and he shouts back up, asking who up there with her is on his side. When three of the queen's eunuchs appear at the window, Jehu orders them to throw her down, at which the men grab Jezebel and hurl her to the ground. The writer describes her blood spattering against the wall and on Jehu's horses as they trample over her corpse. His work done for the day, Jehu enters the palace to grab some food and drink. While he eats, he orders his men to give the queen a proper burial. She was a king's daughter, after all. However, all the soldiers can find are her skull, her hands, and her feet. The rest of her remains have been licked up by hungry dogs. Jehu may have just assassinated Israel's king, but Ahab still has 70 living male relatives. This makes accession to the throne by no means straightforward. Jehu also knows that Israel's capital, Samaria, is a heavily fortified city with weapons, horses, and chariots at its disposal. Rather than steam in, guns blazing, and risk a firefight, which he may not win, he writes to the city's governors, asking them to choose their own successor to Joram. They should then rally behind their new king and fight Jehu and his army for the crown. The officials are terrified. Neither Joram nor Ahaziah were able to overcome Jehu, so if two kings working together failed, how will their one contender fare any better? Their logic appears sound, and so they send a letter back to Jehu, refusing to appoint a king and putting themselves completely at his disposal. Jehu takes the men at their word, and his first task for them is one of the grisliest in the Bible. In the biggest mass execution since the homicidal Edomite shepherd Doeg massacred the priests of Nob on Saul's instructions, Samaria's leaders are ordered to decapitate all 70 sons and grandsons of Ahab, delivering their severed heads in baskets to his temporary base at Jezreel. The men are given a single day to carry out their task, and the heads are brought with a messenger to Jezreel. On Jehu's orders, the gory trophies are piled at the city gates. That way, there will be no doubt that Ahab and his dynasty are history, and that he, Jehu, is now Israel's uncontested king. The next morning, Jehu assures his people that they had no part in the slaughter. It was he who killed Joram, he says, but God who ordered the destruction of Ahab's dynasty. He reminds everyone of Elijah's promise that Ahab's line would cease to exist before slaughtering any friends, advisers, and priests in the city who were loyal to Ahab, leaving no survivors. It is then that Jehu sets out to the city of Samaria, where Israel's principal royal palace is located. On his way, he runs into a party of 42 relatives of Judah's king Ahaziah. They are on their way to Jezreel to visit Joram and his mother Jezebel, unaware that everyone who they are on their way to see is dead. All 42 travellers are rounded up and killed in a nearby town before Israel's new king continues on his journey. As Jehu leaves the town, he is greeted by a holy man named Jehonadab, who pledges his loyalty to Jehu, possibly relieved that the godless dynasty of Ahab and Jezebel has finally been obliterated. Jehu helps the holy man into his chariot and tells him to watch how much zeal Israel's new king has for God. On arriving in Samaria, Jehu kills all remaining members of Ahab's family who are left in the city. The first northern king to openly believe in God since the split with Judah now takes charge of Israel. Keen to wipe out pagan worship in his country, Jehu plans a cunning ambush. The king gathers the rest of Israel's leaders together and makes an announcement that seems at odds with his apparent fondness for God. His own extreme level of Baal worship is going to make Ahab look like an amateur, he tells the men, promising a massive Baal party with an appropriately large sacrifice that will take place in Baal's own purpose-built temple in Samaria. Jehu summons all of Baal's prophets, servants, and priests to the event, and attendance is mandatory. Anyone who fails to show up will be killed, which, given the recent massacre of Ahab's relatives, is seen by no one as an idle threat. Invitations are sent out, and the response is impressive. On the day of the festival, the building is crammed with Baal worshippers. To make the event seem more convincing, Jehu orders robes to be placed on Baal's servants. He and his wingman Jehonadab then order anyone who worships God to exit the building, leaving the pagans to carry out their sacrifices inside. Jehu places 80 guards around the perimeter of the building with strict instructions not to allow anyone inside to leave alive. If they do, they too will be killed. Keeping up the charade, Jehu officiates at the sacrifice, then sends in swordsmen with one order: to kill everyone. The plan works. The element of surprise means that all the Baal worshippers inside the temple are slaughtered. Afterwards, Jehu's men throw the bodies out of the building before entering its inner sanctum, where they drag out the sacred stone that is central to the temple and burn it. They then tear down the temple itself and, as a final flourish, the writer adds that the site is now a public latrine. God appears pleased with Jehu, a remarkable endorsement for a king from the northern kingdom. Still, it's not all roses for Jehu. The king lets himself down by allowing his people to continue worshipping the golden calves set up by Jeroboam at Bethel and Dan. However, Jehu's above average loyalty to God has its rewards. The king is told his family will sit on Israel's throne for 4 generations, a huge reassurance in such turbulent times. Jehu does appear somewhat cavalier in which of God's laws he does or does not follow, and readers are told that under his rule, his kingdom shrinks. Aram's king Hazael invades Israel's Transjordanian territories, and the suggestion is that this is punishment from God. Still, Jehu remains Israel's only believing king, And it is surprising that he has yet to feature in a blockbuster movie that brings his heroic, if bloodthirsty, exploits to a wider audience. Watch this space. The king is also one of the Bible's characters who is documented outside of the book. Jehu's name appears on the Black Obelisk, an ancient limestone sculpture discovered in southern Iraq. On the obelisk, which can be found in the British Museum in London, the king is depicted kissing the ground in front of Assyria's king Shalmaneser III and offering him a gift. Ahaziah's sudden and unexpected death leaves his tiny son Joash as rightful ruler of Judah. However, his grandmother is a homicidal daughter of Jezebel, who is intent on wiping out Judah's monarchy for good. This would be crushing for the nation's national mojo. Judah believed that God promised them an unbroken line of kings who would sit on the same throne as David in perpetuity. The monarchy dying out would be a national disaster, both politically and emotionally. Fortunately for Judah, one of the Bible's bravest and most unsung women is about to single-handedly save the monarchy. Holy Bible is written and produced by me, Chaz Bayfield, with music by Michael Old and John Hawkins Music. Cover art is by Lisa Goff. If you like to, you can send any comments or feedback to contact@holybible.com or follow us on Twitter, that's Holy Bible Podcast. Not Holy Bible as in Holy Bible, that would be way too easy. Holy Bible as in Holy, W-H-O-L-L-Y, Bible, B-U-Y-A-B-L-E. If you like reading as much as you do listening, you can download Snakes and Angels, a secular walk through the first five books of the Bible from Amazon. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.